these are the times we live in. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. It's been lovely to be here to work on the project with Clodagh, but also it's lovely to have a chance to present some kind of quite different research from what I talked about last time. So the title of the paper is "Who Are You Swimming For?" Okay, and it will become kind of clear where I'm going with this as we go. So when I told people back in 2010 that I was swimming the English Channel that summer, one of the most common responses was, "Who are you doing it for?" Or even just the declarative statement, "I'll sponsor you." When I said that I wasn't doing it for charity, responses ranged from surprise to disbelief to overt disappointment in me. Comments included, "You really should," or "You might as well." Others simply just gave me money, which I would give back and ask them to donate to a charity of their choosing. So this then is the starting point for my paper. My interest isn't so much in the act of swimming for charity, but rather why it's so hard not to. How can we understand the normative congealing of the relationship between charitable fundraising and channel swimming, two things that don't obviously immediately go together? And what social and identity processes and relationships are enacted or resisted in the process of what we might think of as swimming for something? So the phenomenon of the charity challenge, if you like, is now a thoroughly ingrained part of contemporary neoliberal society, ranging from charity spectacles like Live Aid, which was like probably the first really big one, and then Comic Relief, things like that, or mass participation sporting events like the London Marathon, for example, or things like Race for Life, those kind of large participation events, down to much more individualised or small group ventures that are ranging from skydiving, trekking, long-distance cycling, and so on. You can do pretty much anything for charity. And in fact, as I flew over on Ryanair today, I was offered the chance to buy lottery tickets for children, to raise money for children, which is another interesting pairing. So these events, these charity challenges, trade investments of time, effort, suffering, and perhaps the facing down of fears, in exchange for monetary donations to a charity of choice. But the flow of benefits doesn't only go in one direction. The individual undertaking the challenge is presented with an opportunity to develop personal skills, perhaps health and fitness, have an adventure, and to engage in a visible act of charity that says something positive about the self to others. As such, compassion through the charity challenge says something about the kind of person that you are. Dedicated, disciplined, compassionate, caring. The charity challenge then can be understood as a kind of identity work that aligns very cleanly with neoliberal values and sedimenting that relationship between charity and sporting endurance. Neoliberalism privileges the autonomous, enterprising self, which is able to exercise efficacy over the embodied self to acquire, evaluate, and act on information and to effect change. These values underpin the inspirational memes that circulate endlessly around social media, and especially among sporting communities. And I had a little picture of several of them that were all basically, if you think you can, and nothing is impossible, and so on. And what these do is that they trumpet the mind over matter message, the idea that your mind will govern your body, will overcome limitation, and that these are messages for self-improvement, I would say, that largely ignore the lived and social and embodied realities and constraints of many people's lives. It's simply not true that these things are not impossible. These values prevail alongside the increasing redistribution of welfare from state bureaucracies onto individuals, a decollectivization of welfare that renders individuals increasingly responsible not only for their own futures, but also for deserving others. Consequently, as Sarah Moore argues in her analysis of ribbon culture, so like the pink ribbons and the age ribbons and so on, she says compassion is not only a prized character trait, but has come to constitute a central aspect of identity in contemporary society. The charity challenge then provides an opportunity not only to be compassionate, but also to demonstrate compassion and other valued traits as part of the doing of identity. It's been very well argued, for example, in the work of Mauss and then in Richard Titmuss's famous study of blood donation, that giving is never purely altruistic, but it's also an expression of people's relationship to society and a demonstration of that relationship. So this isn't to suggest that there is no altruism in giving or in raising money, but rather that it's always about more than altruism. So it's better described at what Titmuss calls creative altruism, whereby, he says, the self is realised with the help of anonymous others. So this is made explicit by Nick Stanhope in his book Blood, Sweat and Charity, which is a how-to text for how to organise a charity challenge or adventure. So this is a quote. He says, charity challenges are powerful vehicles for realising personal goals and raising vast sums of money for charity. They inspire goodwill, raise awareness for important issues, help people find outlets for loss and dissatisfaction, and bring out the best in people. So it's quite a lot of weight being carried by the charity challenge in terms of what it's expected to achieve. It is, he argues, this is a quote, an opportunity to push your limits and demonstrate a commitment to other people's needs as well as your own. So as Mauss tells us in his studies of the gift is always an exchange. So you get something back. The field of health, I think in particular, provides a very powerful vector for some of these trends. Writing about the rise of urban marathons and the phenomenon of running for charity, Sarah Nettleton and Michael Hardy argue that under contemporary neoliberal governance, health has become a key marker of good citizenship, of the responsible and disciplined care of the self. The reflexive individual evaluates health information, assesses and understands risk, and takes appropriate action. So then public displays of athleticism and fitness in the urban marathon affirm the successful management and production of the good body and puts it on display. Running for medical charities particularly solidifies this connection, displaying not only health and fitness through sporting endeavour, but also compassion. And in the running, the body becomes literally branded through the wearing of charity clothing that's branded with the name of the charity on caps and things like that. So Nettleton and Hardy argue that, quote, the care of the self through the cultivation of fitness appears at least symbolically to provide care for others. But I want to suggest that charitable fundraising and channel swimming, rather than being reliant on overt and public displays of health and fitness, as with running, it relies instead primarily on narratives of suffering. And more specifically, it relies on the creation of alliances of suffering, both between and among swimmers, donors, charities, and charity recipients. Now, all charity fundraising, all charity challenge fundraising, relies to some extent on the trading of suffering for donations. And it's a simple fact that an entirely pleasurable or luxurious experience would not earn money, would not earn donation from people. But in the case of channel swimming, and perhaps other ultra-endurance sports perhaps, suffering as a marker of the excessive or extreme nature of the practice itself becomes the defining feature of the act rather than getting fit, for example. And in fact, channel swimming it's a relatively punishing activity that's not necessarily associated with healthful outcomes in terms of overuse injuries and the occasional sort of risk of some kind of chronic acute problems, such as hypothermia or health crises like that. So it's suffering that gives, at least in its public representation, that gives channel swimming, to use Atkinson's phrase, its exciting significance, both within the sport and I think but particularly in its public narrative. So we see this reflected in the Just Giving pages of prospective channel swimmers, which generally highlight the suffering aspects of the endeavour. So you get a lot of talk about pain, sickness, fear, tankers, the cold, pollution, jellyfish, etc., rather than a focus on some of the pleasures of the sport. So unlike entertainment-based fundraising drives like Live Aid or Red Nose Day or mass participation events that focus on participation through the rhetorics of fun and leisure, and I think Race for Life would be an example of that. It's the ability to suffer, narrated by the swimmer, but also imagined by others, because it's rarely witnessed directly because of the nature of the sport. And then this is traded in channel swimming for money. And this is what Nick Stanhope calls in his handbook for charity challenges as swapping blood and sweat for charity. But I'm also going to talk a little bit later on about how this isn't only in one direction, and swimmers talk a lot about gaining kind of inspiration and incentive from the fact that the charity challenge exists. I'll talk a little bit more about that. So the paper In the paper, I'm going to explore the nature of these multi-directional exchanges in the context of channel swimming for charity. And I'm going to argue that the apparently self-evident win-win scenario of charitable swimming, of doing something for yourself whilst doing something good for others, that this actually obscures a quite complex web of obligations, pressures, and unexpected outcomes. So what I'm trying to do is challenge the presumed simplicity of swimming for, and question some of that self-evidence and see what else is going on. So I'm going to just talk briefly about the project that I'm drawing on, about the methodology, just so you know where this is coming from. And then the paper's divided into two main sections. And the first really looks at the motivations that individuals I worked with cited for swimming for charity. And I'm going to talk about this creation of what I've called alliances of suffering between the different players. And then in the second section, I'm going to look at some of the ways that this is resisted within the swimming community and how that works in practice and what social risks that produces. Now, I already feel on slightly shaky ground because questioning charity kind of puts you in a slightly precarious position, which is interesting that I even have to justify doing that. It tells us quite a lot. I want to be very clear that I'm not arguing that charity or charity challenges are bad things, or that altruism has no part in individuals' engagement with those practices. I know and respect many committed swimmer fundraisers, and I'm not making an attack on individual motivations or accomplishments. And one of the things that sociology does best, I think, is to take those concepts, ideas, and beliefs that are treated as self-evident in the wider social context and then to ask critical questions about them. So to ask what exclusions they produce, what coercions, what's left unsaid, and what those critical questions can tell us about the wider social context in which we live, work, and indeed swim. So that's kind of the spirit of the questioning. So to talk about the project, for the last 3 years, I've been working on a project funded by the Economic and Social Research Council, the UK government funder. It's a multi-sited auto-ethnographic and ethnographic study called Becoming a Channel Swimmer. The project came out of my own decision in 2008 to sign up for a channel swim in 2010, and originally focused solely on the channel, but later on branched out into what you might more broadly think of as marathon swimming. Marathon swimming conventionally refers to open water swims of 10 kilometres or over, but my interest is really in the ultra domain of marathon swimming, so English Channel length swims or more, so 20 plus miles, swims that take 10, 15, 20 hours or longer. I mean, there are much longer swims out there. And my particular interest is in what's thought of as channel rules swimming, or traditional swimming in some quarters. So that's swims that are conducted wearing only regular, non-buoyant, non-insulating swimming costume, cap and goggles. Okay, so no wetsuits or anything like that. So it's really speaking back to the original swims. So the first channel swim was in 1875 by Matthew Webb. And it's not an exact replica of the conditions, thank goodness, but because his suit was made of wool. But it's a kind of nostalgic nod to the original conditions about non-assistance. The project involved extensive fieldwork across two full swimming seasons of training, and I visited training sites across the UK, Jersey, Cork, Malta, and I spent a month in Southern California with swimming communities there. So I was following Loic Wacont's autoethnographic account of becoming a boxer and used what he called observant participation. So I was documenting in detail both my own embodied experience of becoming, of training to swim, but also looking at the multiple training sites and their individual sporting subcultures and the online culture as well of the sport. So in addition to the autoethnographic and ethnographic notes, I did 45 interviews with swimmers and other kind of circulating people around the community. And then there were countless informal conversations that make up a vast part of the field notes that were conducted both in and out of the water over food and drink. Food and drink, very important in the channel swimming community. A lot happens over food and drink. On long journeys, in saunas and hot tubs, in my camper van, and on the shores of various stretches of water where I've been visiting. The audio recordings are fantastic for the interviews because a lot of them were conducted in or around these aquatic environments. And so there's an interview in La Jolla in San Diego that's punctuated constantly by barking sea lions. And I did an interview in my camper van in Dover, and we're interrupted repeatedly by the thumping of seagulls just landing on top of the van and sort of jumping up and down. I've also used a lot of auto and biographical accounts, blog postings, histories, really anything I could get my hands on to do with marathon swimming. And I can talk about this some more later. There's a website I've also brought, again, speaking of self-promotion, I published a little magazine that it just has the basic summary of the key findings if some people want to take a copy away. But to move on to my paper, the main body. As I've already said, sponsorship provides a key lens, especially for those outside of the world of marathon swimming, to make sense of it as a practice. And I think there are three key reasons for this. Firstly, it's just basically this very common association we have with endurance sport and charity. Secondly, is high-profile English Channel charity swimmers, and I'm thinking particularly of David Walliams. And I've had several articles published in newspapers about the research that I've done, and that the editors always put a picture of David Walliams in spite of my kind of strong objections to this. Always David Walliams. So the charity thing is very kind of solidified there. And finally, I think that most people who don't swim can't imagine any other reason for doing it, and that there would be no purpose other than raising money, which is to misunderstand, I think, a lot of the pleasures of the sport. But I think that's a very key element. I think it's also important to note that while many of the swimmers I met did include some degree of charitable fundraising, I think about 3/4 of the people I interviewed had raised some money. Very few people raised it directly in the interviews. No one really talked about it until I prompted them to do so. And it's certainly not a big topic of conversation within the Channel swimming community. Okay, it's very much an outward-facing activity. And in fact, I think we could talk about a prohibition within the community of fundraising within that community, because everybody's doing the same activity and the fundraising usually happens facing outwards. But the most common way in which it did get raised, when it was raised, was usually in response to questions from me, was simply that not swimming for something was unimaginable. Okay, so this is someone called Bill, who said, "I couldn't do something like a channel swim without attaching it to a charity, and it just makes perfect sense to use the swim as a vehicle to make a difference for people." So that's a perfect model of that, the tying together of those two ideas. That it makes perfect sense to Bill to connect the two activities speaks volumes about the extent to which endurance sport and charitable fundraising have become normatively linked. And in this way, a channel swim was often described in the interviews as a big thing whose potential for fundraising was too significant to overlook, and indeed to do so would be some kind of moral failure, a missed opportunity to do a good thing. But what was quite interesting was the process of selecting charities. And in many cases, I think this shows us the importance to the decision, the importance of compassion more generally, as opposed to commitment and loyalty to a specific charity or cause. Not always the case. A very small handful of participants talked about a very strong and enduring loyalty to a particular charity, often out of personal experience or a life event, a health crisis or a personal loss. And these are new or other kinds of alliances of suffering, perhaps between people who've experienced a particular disease or personal circumstance. So in these cases, fundraising activities often take on a memorial quality, or serve as a display of gratitude, or a kind of giving back for a service that you yourself have benefited from in some way. But what was much more common was for participants to swim for a particular charity or a portfolio of charities to which they had relatively tenuous connections. And these were generally the results of either shopping around or personal connections with sort of second or third hand others who were involved in a particular charity, or in some cases by direct solicitation from charity activists. And this was something that I experienced as the project became more public, as the research became more public, that I had charities writing to me and offering me kind of fundraising assistance, branded goods and various kinds of support in exchange for me swimming for them. So Phil, for example, he was talking about how he picked his charity, and he said, "With regards to picking a charity, I had no charities in mind. It was a friend, one of my support team, it was his idea because his wife is involved with a charity, and he said, 'Do you fancy doing it for them?'" So in this case, the specific charity is really much less important than the fact that he was swimming for a charity. And so he said, "I don't want to do it for myself. I wanted to achieve something more for someone else." And so distancing the self from the notion of doing it for myself is really important here. Channel swimming is a resource-hungry activity. It demands time, money and effort over a long period of time, exposing the individual to the accusation, really, to appearing excessively self-absorbed and self-regarding, over-investing in the self to the exclusion of others. And so the freedom to invest in the self in this way, then, is compensated for to some extent by the involvement in charitable fundraising at the same time. So for all the neoliberal emphasis on the self as a reflexive project, there's a very fine line to be walked between investment in the self and overdoing that. And we see this in talk of people who kind of are seen to be overinvesting in cosmetic surgery or gym use and so on. So this is a very helpful strategy for managing those that appearance. And so Bill, who I mentioned earlier, who said he couldn't imagine not doing it for charity, he took a much more strategic approach towards his charity selection, focusing on a small Lesotho-based water charity. And it's quite a long quote, but I'll read it out because I think it's quite helpful. He says, "My work has taken me on several occasions to countries where there is no water, or very little water, or dirty water, or diseased water. And I really thought that I had to use the Channel Swim to make a difference for these people. It's not for a country that I know. I don't know Lesotho. But the charity is doing great work. It's a very small charity that I knew would be of interest to people. If they read the story of how the charity was created, they would want to get involved. I knew that nobody could fail to see the interest in it." So Bill had a very impressive charity challenge record and was a very experienced and enthusiastic fundraiser. And in fact, one of the reasons he gave for doing a Channel Swim was that he felt a bit lost since the end of his last charity challenge, and he wanted that kind of excitement of the fundraising and so on back as a kind of consuming activity. So his charity was selected for the quality of the cause, and this resonated very indirectly with his personal experience about water poverty, but also because of the marketable nature of it, of its activities and the message, something that he was able to then mobilise in his campaign to considerable success, raising tens of thousands of pounds. So this issue of marketability is a very key aspect to the charitable challenge. To successfully attract donations, sponsors, people donating, have to feel as though they are doing something to enact change by giving. And that's not the only thing they're doing, because people will give money to friends who are doing something as a gesture of support and so on, even without being involved in the charity. But to give to charity, you have to feel like it does something, right? And we can see this as an inflection of this neoliberal conviction that individuals are able to affect positive change over their own lives and those of deserving others. And I say deserving because there are several notable absences from the roster of charities that are the primary targets for fundraising. It's very rare, for example, to see people swimming for politically controversial or activist charities. So abortion rights, for example, would not be a good target for charity fundraising because it's so controversial. And in the current climate, it's very hard to imagine someone swimming for charities that support immigrants or travellers or other disadvantaged groups that sociologist Imogen Tyler describes as having been socially abjected by neoliberalism. So this points more broadly, I think, to the disarticulation of charitable causes from the broader issues and debates that significantly muddy the waters in terms of what constitutes a good intervention. And so you get this flattening out of complexity that it could be argued is necessary in order to offer people a tangible outcome in exchange for their money. And it's the charities themselves that are the prime movers in this simplification, because they've had to become increasingly entrepreneurial in a competitive charity market, given the shift of welfare responsibilities onto individuals and charities. So, for example, Samantha King, in her analysis of pink ribbon culture, you know, the breast cancer movement, she highlights the focus of fundraising on breast cancer, as treating breast cancer as a scientific or medical problem that can be resolved through increased funding of research, rather than, for example, as an economic, an environmental, or a social problem. And so things like environmental degradation or health inequalities, both of which are implicated in breast cancer, these are problems whose resolutions are much less amenable to charitable marketing and to fundraising than the search for a cure. So the charity challenge then gets mediated by the charities themselves, and their own self-narratives, which in turn are constituted by this neoliberal emphasis on these demonstrations of compassion. But I think it's, again, to go back to this idea, it's important to note that the exchange of suffering the exchange of personal suffering for funds for the relief of suffering doesn't only travel one way. And in exchange for their commitments to charitable fundraising and beyond the kind of innate rewards of the challenge itself, many of the participants I spoke to talked about this kind of additional and quite highly prized incentive. The charity itself became an incentive to maintain an arduous training schedule and to endure under moments of physical stress. So Robert, for example, explicitly cited swimming for charity as a source of training motivation. And he said, so I deliberately build that pressure on myself. Not because I think I will respond better on the day, but when I think I can't be bothered to drive down to Dover this weekend to swim, I think, get your ass down there, because people have given for charity. Others talked about using their knowledge of the suffering of others via the charitable cause as a means of putting their own swimming suffering into proportion. So they would say, a lot of people said things like, well, if person with this disease can endure that terrible pain, then I can endure this temporary suffering. And it's in this way that I think it's helpful to talk about alliances of suffering, because I think this draws attention to the multidirectional flow of gifts and obligations in swimming for. And not least because it highlights, I think, the potential flattening out of differences between forms of suffering that get allied in this exchange. And that even though that's the suffering is treated as the same in that moment, in fact, temporary involuntary suffering has very little in common with involuntary and intractable suffering. And so I think it's important to think about those alliances and how they're constituted. Charitable fundraising also has the effect of making a swim much more public than it would otherwise have been, drawing attention to it and intensifying the pressure on the swimmer to train, which is what's being mobilised positively. And this is particularly important in a sport like channel swimming, because channel swimming lacks spectacle, literally lacks spectacle, in the sense that it's very long, slow, repetitive endeavour. It has very little to offer spectatorship. It's incredibly dull to watch. But it also takes place literally out of sight. It's very rare to see a channel swim. 5 people saw me swim the channel, and 3 of them were paid by me to be there. You see swims remotely by watching the GPS tracks and so on, so it's a very kind of mediated form of watching. But generally they're hard to see. So fundraising websites then become a means of making the self and the venture visible, and visible to others. So this too is part of the performance of compassion, alongside the demonstration of other valued qualities like discipline, self-efficacy, and so on. And I would say this isn't confined to charitable fundraising either. I keep a blog that I promote and put on social media to get more people reading it. And of course, I've also made swimming a very public part of my professional life as well. So you could say that that's also performing similar functions, using swimming to say something about myself and certain perhaps qualities that I would like to think of as being socially valued. So as Sarah Moore notes, referencing Goffman, obviously, identity is what we do, not what we are. So it's an active process. But it's not costless either, and this is what I want to move on to look at some of the resistance and some of the problems that this throws up. I recently made the very difficult decision to cancel an English channel swim. I'd originally booked this 2 years ago, and it was scheduled for the 15th of July, for 2 weeks' time. The decision is the result of a complicated knot of factors, but primarily it was because of the cold. The unseasonably cold spring has left channel water temperatures lower than in previous years, and based on hard-learned experience, it is beyond what I felt I am capable of for a long swim. I posted the decision on my blog and on social media and was gratified to receive many encouraging messages of support and endorsement, and we could talk about how we make ourselves visible to others there. I received 2 very aggressively worded emails from people I know online but have never met in person, which accused me of using the cold as an excuse for my lack of training and commitment to the process. And obviously this raises a whole new set of interesting questions and a paper for another day about how people are invested in other people's swims in all kinds of complicated ways. But I also received two heartbreaking emails from separate individuals expressing their despair in the face of upcoming swims that they felt unable to complete because of the unseasonable cold, but which they felt unable to withdraw from because of the fundraising. They both talked about a sense of trapped foreboding in which they were inevitably going to let people down either way, if they cancelled the swim or if they failed the swim. I spoke to one on the phone and she sobbed in despair at an exciting adventure having become such an intolerable burden that she could find no way out of at this point. I've seen this mounting pressure many times before and in the interviews, and it's not uncommon for swimmers to, quite close to the swim date, write to their sponsors prior to the swim, offering to return all of the money that they've donated in an attempt to remove this unbearable sense of obligation. And this time it's obligation to both known individuals, so friends who've donated, and unknown individuals who would donate, and also the recipients. So while the gift of suffering creates a sense of obligation in others to donate money, their donations in turn create a sense of obligation for the swimmer. And this is compounded by technologies like Just Giving, actually, where I'm sure you're familiar, that you give the money and it's received by the charity in advance of the actual event. So it's not like you get a list of sponsors and then you go around and collect the money. So in a sense, it's harder to get the money back or to take it back. And this highlights the extent to which swimming for a charity is never simply an add-on, a benign add-on. It changes the nature of the swim. It's a different kind of activity to swimming for yourself. So this idea that you might as well do it for charity actually doesn't hold up when you look at what swimming for does to the challenge itself. But for some of the swimmers, there was much more active resistance, this sort of after-the-fact horror, that some kind of preempted that actively, mostly simply by not swimming for charity. And so David, for example, rejected the possibility of swimming for charity in favour of a much more pleasure-oriented motivation. So he said, "I was just swimming because I wanted to swim. There are lots of causes that I want to raise money for and do, but I didn't want the pressure or the hassle or the detail because I'd spend too much time on it and so much organisation doing it that I decided to just leave it." So David's decision to swim because he wants to swim is a socially risky one in a context where swimming for is what you're supposed to do. As Sarah Moore says in relation to breast cancer charities, in a culture of compassion, those who choose not to be charitable are judged to be deviant, maladjusted human beings. However, this is negotiated, I think that's a bit harsh, but this is negotiated by David partly by signalling his charitable identity elsewhere, that he gives money elsewhere, and partly by highlighting his desire to not wanting to do the job badly. So he does position himself as compassionate, disciplined, and self-reflexive, which are all socially valued traits. And I'm not suggesting that he's not those things, but what I'm interested in is the fact that he has to say them, that it has to be accounted for. Okay. Now, another form of resistance, a much more active form of resistance, came from Greg, who took a very critical approach and launched a quite enthusiastic and vociferous tirade in the interview against individuals who he felt overstated their charitable intentions and kind of milked it too much. So I'll read this. It's quite a long quote, but I'll read that. He says, "What I object to is when this kind of thing is trumpeted about and presented as someone doing something because they have a calling to do something with a charity," and then he quotes, "I'm not swimming the channel because I want to swim the channel or because I want a challenge. I'm swimming because I want to raise this money for this cause or that cause." And he goes on to say, "It really irritates me. There's this person at my swimming club who sends emails about 3 times a year saying, 'I'm doing this now. The reason I'm doing it is for this cause.' And my response is, 'Bollocks. The reason you're doing it is because you want to swim the channel.'" So, sorry. Greg's cynicism doesn't reflect a complete rejection of charitable swimming. In fact, although he never intended to swim for charity, following a comment from his mother that people will think it's a bit weird if you don't, he eventually decided that it's probably a big enough challenge that people might want to give some money. A lot of people reached a similar decision, perhaps by receiving money unsolicited, which has happened to quite a few people. And so what people often do is just open a Just Giving account, but don't promote it. And then if people ask, they just send it on to them, or they put it in their email signatures but don't actively engage with it. But what's interesting about Greg is that he's insisting on the dual aspects of swimming for charity, on the importance of recognising personal benefits that accrue from a channel swim. And he's resisting those who are deemed to be overplaying the compassion card and trying to position themselves as morally superior to non-charitable swimmers. And as Greg said, you really don't want to be that person. So instead, Greg insists on the self-transformative pleasures to be gained from the challenge of channel swimming. And therefore, he produces another alliance of suffering, this time among the channel swimmers themselves, for whom the kind of suffering in the water becomes a kind of marker of collective belonging, of enjoying that activity together as a form of pleasure, excitement, as well as struggle. And so that's a kind of defining point of subcultural belonging as well. So there's another alliance there. And as I said, it's generally not done to solicit sponsorship within that group, mostly because within a group of channel swimmers, which most people don't find themselves within a large group of channel swimmers most of the time, but as a swimmer you do, that kind of swimming becomes quite mundane. And so you've not done anything sort of exceptional to warrant the money. It's the people who then do multiple swims or very big cold swims who might then attract funding from within the community. But generally it's from without. Okay, so to conclude, what I've tried to argue today is that there's a normative expectation, especially from those outside of the channel swimming community, that people should swim for a charitable cause. Consequently, the decision to swim for a charity, however much conceptualized and experienced as an individual choice and an individual act of good, also requires adherence to a very specific code of behaviour and discourse. It's only in a social and cultural context where the demonstration of compassion has become normalised as a prized character trait, alongside other qualities such as self-efficacy, reflexivity, etc., that this sedimented linking of marathon swimming and charity is possible, and why not swimming for charity is so difficult. These normative connections, like all altruistic practices, produce a complex exchange of obligations. I've argued that these exchanges are articulated primarily through alliances of suffering, which potentially obscure the differences between forms of suffering. Following on from this, I've also suggested that the act of swimming for can also work to disarticulate the cause from the wider social and political issues within which it's embedded. And this is a flattening out of complexity that's kind of exacerbated by these neoliberal values, which position individuals as most responsible for their own futures. And I would also finally suggest that the focus on suffering that the charitable fundraising generates actually presents a very distorted representation of the sport itself, which also has very significant pleasures, but it becomes then you can only talk about suffering and not talk about the pleasures of the sport. So in making the case, again, I want to emphasise that I'm not impugning the values or intentions of those who have or are going to swim for charity. I'm not denying altruistic intent or the many positive effects of money raised in this way. Instead, my point is to highlight the normative pressures to swim for charity and to challenge the ways in which it's treated as self-evident and benign. I hope that my paper has shown that swimming or other activities for charity is always about more than altruism, generating a complex network of multi-directional exchanges and obligations that change the very nature of the challenge rather than adding on to it. So, if you're doing a channel swim, in fact, I know there are some channel swimmers here, when someone asks, who are you swimming for? The answer, I think, is far more complicated than we might first think. Thank you very much.